Hello, welcome again to Comic Connoisseur. Tonight we'll be talking about the rise of the celebrity writer, the celebrity author, and the detriment it is to comics. And of course, I'm my co-host JT from Saskatoon.
Hey, everybody.
Also with us is Red Ink.
I don't know why I'm here.
All right.
Do so, any of us know why we're here?
To serve our purpose. But so when I say the celebrity writer, the celebrity author, what I mean is the point in comicdom where a writer of a comic book is more than just the person writing the book. They're also the draw to the book. They're a name. It's actually a celebrity behind that name.
And they've become that, rock stars.
Yes, and that becomes a draw of the book and ultimately a detriment to the industry. So, obviously, if we have to talk about celebrity writers, we have to talk about the first true celebrity in the comic book creation, comic book industry. Stan Lee, I think, fits that bill of the first celebrity of the comic book writing world. Would that be a fair statement to say, guys?
I think so. I mean, he's certainly the first one to get out and, you know, make a name for himself.
Market his name.
He becomes as much a character as any of the characters that he had a hand in creating.
And as much and as little of a hand that will be a different topic we will avoid for tonight. Just partly out of respect and partly because I think that would be a little bit of a misnomer. I'm saying that mostly so I know that as well, because I have a habit of going into that tangent. But we're going to.
You don't want to pee on his grave today?
Not today. But let's talk about it. I think that, you know, Stan Lee, of course, was the first. But, you know, you had lots of writers in the 70s and 80s that came and did their job. And nobody really, like, was like, oh, my God, we need to get the next title of, what was it, like, Steranko or something like that? Or, you know
Jim Steranko.
Yeah, these were guys that just did their job. Shooter. Did their job, came in, got out. You know, you'd have to find, like, the diehard of diehard fans back then who specifically followed a specific writer from book to book.
You know why they're doing this these days, right? Why they're actually pushing writers to be famous instead of over artists?
They don't want another image.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They don't want all their best artists to leave and form another company.
So they're neutering them.
They're neutering them, and the other thing is, they're only hiring them once on a blue moon.
Yeah.
In other words, they're hiring people fresh out of college who can barely draw fucking web comics, let alone professional comics. And these guys will fucking work for a meal and a place to stay, let alone any money. And once in a while, they'll bring in a well-known artist like Cho or somebody.
Or yeah, you're
to draw either, like, they'll mostly do covers.
Yeah,
and once in a blue moon they'll make them do an actual fucking comic.
You're absolutely right, and it's also the problem that Marvel has specifically, where they have one artist that's doing five different books, five different months, and they just move they pass the artist around like a blunt at a party.
Right,
and I think that it's a shame, because what readers like is consistency in tone and in art. And to have the art change every month or every other month, it ruins the consistency. And I think that's a, like I said, I think it's a detriment to people who are what I would call subscription readers, people who month to month read the book. And that's used to be their bread and butter. You know, but if we look at the rise of the celebrity writer, you know, I really think that the first name that comes to the mind, people, the one that people really looked forward to and looked for after, you know, after the rise of Stan Lee, you know, I think Claremont made a big name for himself in the 80s.
Well, yeah, I mean, he reinvigorated the X-Men, and, you know, when you talk about Claremont in the 80s, you also kind of have to bring up John Byrne, because, I mean, he was,
John
you
Byrne
know,
was
firing
everywhere.
On all cylinders.
Yeah, John Byrne was everywhere.
On all cylinders.
Because John Byrne did stuff on Marvel and DC with reinvigorating multiple brands. And John Byrne was definitely another But John Byrne was also an artist, so he prided himself as being the whole package, so to speak.
Yeah, but, I mean, but he was a threat or double threat.
But one thing I think, like I said, if we're talking about an author who's specifically just a writer, like I said, but, if I had to pick a name after Stan Lee, I think Claremont is it. Go ahead, Red.
I don't think Claremont counts, honestly. All right. I don't think people bought X-Men specifically for Claremont. The first celebrity artist or writer, I would say, would either be Neil Gaiman or, what's his name, Alan Moore. Because they rarely wrote, when they wrote comics, people would actually go and buy those fucking comics.
Yeah, I mean, from some of the stuff I've read in the past, like, Gaiman is an incredible artist on the page, like, with the printed word and all that. But Alan Moore, that dude was practically Sutter Kane back in the day. You know, I mean, you had stuff like, you know, the anatomy lesson of Swamp Thing. You had The Watchmen, even modern day stuff like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and then, you know, America's Best Comics with like Tom Strong and all those characters. Like, when he writes something, people stand up and pay attention.
I think Red has a good point. The rise of mainstream celebrity into the comic world. Neil Gaiman and his foray in the 90s definitely fits that bill to a T.
Yeah.
And
Claremont, like, he got famous later on, and it's like when you let a wine age. It's as time went on, as people discovered his work, he got more and more famous. But I mean, from the get-go, like from page one, you had guys like Gaiman, Alan Moore, Grant Morrison. I mean, he came out swinging with a lot of his work, and, you know, he took a goofy title like the Doom Patrol, and it became like this surreal examination of superhero comics. And, you know, he created characters like, you know, Crazy Jane and Danny the Street. You know, I think he's the one that came up with the story idea that the Chief was responsible for the original Doom Patrol's accidents that, you know, made them the freaks that they are. And what do you guys think about that? Like, Grant Morrison, you know, kind of the shaman of comics, as it were.
Grant Morrison makes some good fucking comics.
Yes.
But some of them are really fucking out there. Like that one where the guy orders that beach body.
Flex Mentallo.
Yeah, Flex Mentallo. That's way the fuck out there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that one's kind of hard to wrap my head around. What's the Invisibles? Like, I've reread that at least twice in my life, and every time there's something new, but it is a bit of a mind screw. You know, it's this group of countercultural revolutionaries, you know, came out in the 90s. So you got this guy, King Mob, who looks like, you know, some sort of anarchist. You get one of the characters was a cross-dresser. You know, there were so many. He took all these ideas from his experiences with drugs and trying to, you know, figure out his own religion sort of thing. And it became like like, when you look at some of the ideas in The Matrix, some of the more creepy, the ones that really turn your brain into slush, is similar a lot to some of the stuff he put in The Invisibles.
I see. So yeah, we have that period of the 90s where where writers like Neil Gaiman was hired, and I think Grant Morrison was a case of a comic book writer that rose to celebrity versus a celebrity hired to write comics. They both count for this term, but I always think Neil Gaiman was an interesting one. You know, this actually takes me into another topic, part of this, where you had cases where Hollywood people went to comics, specifically Joss Whedon of Buffy fame and main directorial fame went into writing X-Men for a period, and you had JMS do the same thing. You know, someone who's in movies and television going into writing comics.
Yeah, well, I mean, a great example of that to come off of that is Kevin Smith. You know, with his run on Daredevil that was, you know, like Guardian Devil, and then when he recreated Green Arrow in the early aughts with Phil Hester art, which is one of my favorite runs of Green Arrow, by the by.
Don't bring up Kevin Smith. For the Batman, doesn't it piss himself?
I'm sorry, that never happened, and I refuse to discuss the topic. Yeah, if there's... That is, like, one of the very few black marks that I have in my fandom love of Kevin Smith is, you know, is it Batman Odyssey, I think, is the one you're talking about, Red?
Yeah.
Where there was this incredible heat bloom, and it caused me to void my bladder, and it's like... Okay, one, I don't think that's the first time Batman's pissed himself, because... As hardcore as he is, I'm pretty sure the first time he met, like, the Matt Hagen Clayface, you know, it's like this giant mound of mud that turns into people and things. Pretty sure, you know, busted out a turtle head or something.
Well, all I have to say about that is a famous line from one of the Kevin Smith's Batman books is, by the way, I saw you changing and I saw your junk.
Yeah. He's not shy about making those references, but...
But the pissing himself from a big ball of flame is an actual phenomenon that happens to fucking firefighters. Kevin Smith read about it and stuck it in the comic and upset a lot of fucking Batman fans.
Yes. But, So, yes, so... Like Red said, the celebrity writer is being touted now because the big two are trying desperately to avoid the celebrity, as JT would put it, double threat of the artist writer by neutering the artist now. And I think that's a shame. I think that if you have a good system, it can stand to scrutiny. If you have to put all these controls in your system, then you don't have a good system. You're just trying to delay the inevitable.
I think what's happening right now is they're actually shooting themselves in the foot, because eventually all these great artists that are out there are going, well, if they want to do, they can form another company. Like, nothing's going to stop them.
Unless they got some sort of non-compete clause in their contracts.
They just need the money to do it.
Yeah. But when you talk about celebrity, again, like, you got guys who became famous and have a certain type of celebrity, I think of Mark Waid. Now, Mark Waid in the 80s or late 80s into the early 90s, he got rightfully so, a whole lot of fanboy love and a certain amount of fame from some seminal work on The Flash. And, you know, he created Impulse, he got it. He really never had any problems with being a famous comic book artist until recently, and I think Ben would be the best one to explain this because I can barely wrap my head around his bullshit.
I think Mark Waid let his celebrity get to his head, because before, I've heard him in interviews, I've heard him talk to other fans, he never was this combative. I mean, you want to talk about the combative celebrity writers, you know, just look under combative celebrity writer in the book and you'll see Peter David's picture underneath it, underneath the dictionary heading. But Mark Waid, he was never this combative until recently. And again, I think a big part of it is his celebrity got to his head. He thinks that the comic book readers need him, not the other way around, because, again, one thing that they have to keep in mind is without the readers, they have no job. And if you don't really go far pissing off your customer base.
Well, no. But, I mean, specifically, because you were telling me about this a while back, Ben, the whole lawsuit.
Yeah. Like,
can you kind of just...
Okay, I'll explain. I'll explain it to you. There was a guy named Diversity in Comics. It was the name of his YouTube channel. His YouTube channel was Podunk Little Nothing. It was nothing to be afraid of unless you were just neurotic for some insane reason. And Mark Waid was neurotic for some insane reason. This guy was literally a dude who, in the front seat of his car, after going into the comic book store, would be like filming with his camera phone saying, "Yeah, I just picked up this issue of Daredevil. It kind of sucks right now, so don't pick it up, guys." And that's pretty much what he was doing. And for some reason, the whole comic book writers industry decided that this guy was Public Enemy number one. They had to circle the wagons. They had to go scorched earth on this guy. And
it wasn't the whole industry. It was Marvel.
Okay, it was most. Yeah, you're right. It was Marvel. And again, this was way over the top. So Diversity in Comics decided he would do a Kickstarter, saying, "I want to do a comic called Jawbreakers, which is not going to be political at all. There's not going to be any politics. It's going to be like a standard, fun comic."
It was literally, "I like G.I. Joe, and I want to make my own G.I. Joe."
Yeah, and he got funded. So what happened was he got an artist, he got a team going, and he got a deal with Antarctic Press to publish. And Antarctic Press, at first, was like, "Yeah, we're staying behind this guy 100%. All he wants to do is just make fun comics. There's nothing political in this comic. This comic is fun. If you want fun comics again, come to us." Mark Waid, what happened to Mark was Mark Waid, he, on his Facebook, said, "I don't like this guy. I'm going to personally call the president of Antarctic Press and say, you do not do business with this guy, or else I'll use my power and influence to harm my Antarctic Press in some way." And Mark Waid bragged about this. He gave the specifics of what he did on Facebook. And the problem with that is there was a contract between the Diversity in Comics guy and Antarctic Press. And by Mark Waid, a third party, trying to influence an already sealed contract and business deal, he broke law. And this is a lawsuit with damages, and everything that Mark Waid admitted to is online. And Mark Waid thinks that his best defense to this is to say, "But the guy's a Nazi.
He's a bad man. Orange man, bad."
Pretty much. And again, the one thing that is amazing is Mark Waid thinks that's a defense. He thinks that he can get a whole slew of other comic book writers to come into the courtroom to be character witnesses, even though in a civil trial you can't have character witnesses.
Yeah.
You can't have 100 people come and say, "Oh, but JT is a real nice guy.
He kicked a puppy." No, I mean, like, I love a lot of Mark Waid's work, but you can't pull a next level dick move like this and expect people to like you after that.
I love impulse.
Okay, Red.
Sorry, Red. You go first.
The problem I have with Mark Waid is it's gatekeeping. And the industry is already fucking going under. Let's just admit that. Like, comics are at an all-time low.
Yes.
And DC's gatekeeping comics, like, sorry, gatekeeping writers and artists out of the fucking industry is a bad fucking idea.
Because you hurt everybody with it. And DC Comics, for instance, their sales are half of what they were from this same point last year. Half.
Mm.
I mean, it's bad. And Mark Waid, I loved his early work. His Flash run, some of the best Flash work done since Carmine Infantino. It's Impulse, one of my five favorite characters. No disputing, he wrote a lot of the books I loved growing up. But I could say the same thing about Peter David. He did lots of work I loved growing up, but I can look at these guys and say, "Yeah, I loved your work, but you're a douche."
Yeah, because when you think about some famous writers that with their early stuff I loved, like Jonathan Hickman, what's his knob that created Walking Dead?
Kirkman.
I love Kirkman's work. Like, I never really read Walking Dead. I became a fan of his reading Invincible, Because Invincible, you know, it's Mark Grayson, his dad, Omni-Man, is basically Superman, so this is the adventures of a more modern take on Superboy. It was fun. Like, there were high stakes and really dark shit happened in that comic, but it brought so much fun and fanboy love back to the medium. And then you read, like, later on how he may or may not have done some really shady shit to fans and other writers, and it's just all rumors and hearsay. And I mean, at what point do guys like this deserve to lose their celebrity? You know, I think like a Jim Shooter's another one. Like, for years I read about Jim Shooter, you know, this mountain of a man who is EIC at Marvel Comics. He got his start at like 16 years old writing Legion of Superheroes, like one of the gold standards in comic books, in my opinion. But then you read later on, like, the behind the scenes stuff of how he was to artists and other writers, and how he was just this apparently a rampaging dick to the Marvel bullpen. So I'm going to ask you guys, like, are there any writers that you think deserve to lose their celebrity now? And can't say Mark Waid because we already talked about him.
Bendis,
definitely.
Bendis is the accumulation of what's all going wrong with fucking writers as celebrities. See, writers occupy a higher position in most comic book industries than artists do, so they have more influence. And that's a bad fucking thing when you have a celebrity with that much fucking influence over your comics. Suddenly he joins a new company and he's writing 14 different fucking books.
And he's making grand changes to the whole universe.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bendis is a great example of this because remember, like, for 6 to 8 months, there was all these Bendis is coming things in comics, in DC Comics.
Yeah.
Bendis is coming. Bendis is coming. Oh, my God, this is going to be great. Bendis is coming. And then it was like a bowel movement.
Okay, not surprisingly, I'm slightly disagreeing with you, Ben. I just want to say that some of the story ideas that he's introduced in his run on Superman, I've enjoyed. Not everything, but a few of them here and there. And I think
what is wrong with you?
A great many things, and we don't have nearly enough time to talk about it. And also, he brought back Young Justice, which...
He ruined it at the same time he brought back.
Young Justice is a fucking monkey paw wish.
Yes.
In other words, you brought back somebody's wish came true. Young Justice is back, but guess what? They're all fucked up.
The soul is gone. It's a zombie.
Yes, the turkey's dry.
I mean, Young Justice, I mean, the one thing that I picked up on immediately, Red picked it up too, was this Teen Lantern character, which is basically Riri Williams ported to from the Marvel Universe to the DC Universe. Because it's almost the same damn thing. It's a teenage black girl who was able with technology, recreate the same powers of a Green Lantern ring. The Guardians went raised planet on species that did far less than this.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
The Guardians made the fucking Martians weak to fire because they're too fucking powerful. The Guardians made the Kryptonians isolationists because they were too fucking powerful. What do you think? How do you think they would react once they find out, hey, there's a human that can make our fucking rings? I don't think they'd be too fucking happy.
They nuke the plan and be like, okay, now we're safe again.
Yeah, so I mean...
Because remember, the armors acquired basically only barely got away with it because they lived in another dimension.
This is true, the antimatter universe.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I mean, there's so many writers that got famous based on their works that they become the ultimate expressions of don't eat your heroes, kids.
I think the biggest lesson here is not only don't meet your heroes, is also keep your humility.
I would argue that they didn't completely keep their humility, but the creators of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Eastman and Laird, have, I think, and it can be argued for and against, but I think by and large, they haven't lost their shit as much as some people would say they have, you know, compared to guys like Wade or Bendis.
I mean, I think the fact that they haven't had a lot of exposure is a big thing because, it's Peter Laird, I believe. Peter Laird keeps very private, a very private life. I mean, and Kevin Eastman has that rock star mentality, but I think he pretty much abandoned the Turtles creatively ever since he bought Heavy Metal magazine. Which I think was like a childhood wish of his. Like, I always wanted to own Heavy Metal magazine. I got all this fucking money from making the Turtles. I'm like, I'm going to buy Heavy Metal magazine.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, they don't actually, like, they have whatever, when they sold the rights years ago, like, they still have a piece of that, but they don't have any direct creative control anymore. But they're always going to be known as the fathers of Leo, Raph, Don, and Mikey.
That's true, but I think that at the same time, I think Laird, the last of the two that had any creative interest in the Turtles, I think he got all that out of his system after the 03 series. I think he got to do the storylines he wanted to do, and he was content with saying, "Well, I'm done." Lifted his hands up and said, "I got it out of my system now."
Yeah, and some writers and artists need that.
I think that's a good thing. I think that because when people asked him about the Michael Bay Turtles, his response was basically, "I'm not invested in it anymore. I don't care."
Yeah. No.
For creators, that's fucking hard.
Well, yeah, but I mean, what do you think, Eastman and Laird? Do you think they're still deserving of whatever fame they have?
They've never had much fame.
Well,
that's in the indie circles only.
Yeah. Another name that I can think of as far as, you know, writer, artist, creators, again, fans for and against, is Lou Scheimer from Filmation Studios. I mean.
Oh, God.
Well, okay, look, I know you're not a big fan of, like, how he ran it, like, with the rotoscoping and the reusing animation, reusing backgrounds, but, I mean, this guy loved animation. He loved creating stuff, and I'm not saying he was a saint or anything, because, you know, I never met the man before he passed, but...
You got a good point, but at the same time, it's, this is a man that also made Robin and the Dreamweavers.
Okay, that's not what I'm talking about, and it's like, he was in this business for the love of the art form of animation, you know, creating stories. And yeah, he was in it to make a buck too. And anytime I read writers or artists talking about how, you know, it's so commercial, and that's not, that's like when you accuse a band of selling out and they're not making music the way, you know, you want to do it because you want to create, but you also got to eat. So I think Lou Scheimer is fully deserving of his fame because he was one of the last great American animators, you know. And then he's right up there with Don Bluth and Chuck Jones.
That's a little bit of an overestimation, but I'll let you have your belief.
I'm not saying he's on the same level as Lucha, just in terms of fame, in terms of when you think American animation, Lou Scheimer might come into the periphery of your thought process, is what I'm saying. I don't know. What do you think, Red? Do you think Lou Scheimer is deserving whatever fame he still has and since he's passed?
I think he deserves whatever fame he has, but I don't think he's that famous. I think eclipse his own name.
Yeah. I'm not saying he's, like, super famous still, but, I mean, he has a certain level of notoriety amongst fans of animation, especially guys like us who grew up in the 80s.
I can grant you some of that, but let's stick back to comic book writers, and let's talk about the downfall of the celebrity. I think we touched a little bit on Mark Waid, but the problem is when, in Michael and Brian Michael Bendis. But I think that that when you have writers like Dan Slott, Brian Michael Bendis, and others with that level of celebrity, you know, they're the inmates and they're running the asylum, because you have editors in chief that are powerless to the celebrity because they hired these guys for the name. They can't put no name, nobody on the book after, you know, if this guy's acting up, because they're like, we spend all this money on this guy's name. And that, I think, is dangerous too, because then you have books that have shitty storylines that have to go on and on until the writer decides, okay, I'm done with this book now, and drops a husk of a book that could have been great. And the whole of the editorial has to keep on dragging a book that doesn't sell because they had a celebrity writer attached to it.
You're not wrong. What do you think about that, Red?
I think Ben has a point. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what other artists do you think are falling from on high right now, besides the aforementioned Bendis and Wade?
Dan Slott. Easily Dan Slott. Joss Whedon had some good stuff early in his comic writing career, but I think that stuff he touches nowadays turns to shit. I mean,
yes, because I like, okay, whether or not you like Dan Slott, I'm not going to debate you on that. You don't have to like stuff I like. I think he deserves it. A lot of fans don't. I mean, when you think of other, you know, writers or artists that were...
He's history's greatest monster.
No, that would be Bob Kane. Like, when I, for years, and this is just me, folks, for years, me, like a lot of fans, practically deified Bob Kane as the creator of Batman. And it was only after the advent of the internet and learning about the history behind the creation of Batman, and then you hear about Bill Finger, and then you see... As some of the villainous stories I've been told of, like, how Stan Lee may have traded some of his creating partners, Bob Kane is worse, because he screwed Bill Finger out of... And I'm not just talking financially, just the fact that he screwed him out of his rightful connections to the Masked Manhunter, the Dark Knight, and how he died in, like, poverty and basically died alone. And here he is riding high on the hog for all these years. Bob Kane is comic book history's greatest monster. You know. I don't know, what do you guys think about that? Like, is he still deserving of his fame? Should we just not acknowledge that anymore? I didn't mean to take the whole room down, but...
Well, Bob Kane did a lot of shit, like fucking put in a contract that Bill Finger can never be acknowledged as the creator of Batman before he died and shit like that.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, he did that on purpose. It's not like Stan Lee saying, yeah, I created Spider-Man, I created the X-Men, you know, I created Daredevil. Like, I think Wally Wood might have to argue about that. I think Jack Kirby might have a thing or two to say. But... You know, that's impolite and insincere, but it's not outright fucking douchebaggery on a level I am not comfortable acknowledging can happen. I mean,
some people are petty like that.
Yeah, but I mean, you think about guys like Schuster and Siegel, like the creators of Superman, how they got, whether they were too naive to know what was going on or the fact that they literally just got screwed coming and going with the creation of the last son of Krypton. And it wasn't, was it within the last 10 years, finally, their families, you know, you get it added, Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, and they get their cut of that pie. But
well, There's a thing people, like, forget about the attitude of comics back then.
It was kind of mercenary work?
It was mercenary work, and the other thing is, people didn't give a fuck. Like, I'm pretty sure Joe Shuster and... Jerry Siegel, if you talk to them while they were making that shit, they gave zero shits. It was just a fucking way to make some money. And getting recognition, they didn't care. It wasn't until much later where Superman became super fucking famous that their kids were like, well, we should get a piece of this pie.
And then they had just kind of not, I don't want to say given up in a bad way, but by that point, like by, say, 1978 with the first Superman film, they were just so beat down by what had happened in their own lives, right? That they just didn't care. Like, they couldn't bring themselves to care.
No. These, we're talking about men that were near the end of their lives. I mean, it's they felt like they had a good run, and honestly, if you read a lot of what they say, they really didn't have any grudges.
Well, I'm not saying they had grudges. I'm just saying, you know, like, they are very deserving of their fame, but to a certain extent, you're just like, oh yeah, Siegel and Shuster created Superman. But, you know, you can have that conversation. You don't think, yeah, they created Superman. Like, there's not that awe or admiration. I mean, when you talk about guys wholly deserving of their fame and their legend, you know, the king, Jack Kirby. And I'm not saying he was a saint either. For all I know, he was a raging asshole.
Kirby was interesting in the fact that the people who read comics and the comics loved him. It wasn't until the near end of Kirby's life that he gained any sort of mainstream celebrity status of any sort. And even then, it was minor. It wasn't until he was dead that he was really deified by the masses.
I would argue that deification came after his death, but he was insanely popular for him. I mean, you think about in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, one of the most infamous jumping of ships when he left, you know, Marvel. He left the House of Ideas for the Distinguished Competition across the street and created, you know, the Kirbyverse. You know, he created the Fourth World and the Demon, and, you know, made Jimmy Olsen less of a goof, and, you know, in there was this, there was this magic in the stuff he created back then that you kind of would have to be ignorant on the level of stupidity to not realize. No, certain his fame, more fame came to him after he passed, and I think it was 94. I might be wrong on that.
It was.
You know, but it's guys like that. I mean, again, you go back to Stan deserved it. Jack deserved it. You know, Wally Wood, Bill Everett, Claremont, all these guys deserve it. It's, by and large, some of the fame, it went to their heads. Again, like Kirkman, like Wade has in recent years, and I'm sure Dan Slott to a point. I've read some interviews where his words have come, he's not the nicest guy some days. But I don't think he's an asshole.
He is.
Why are we whispering?
Here's a spoiler. But yeah, I think that basically the point being made is the celebrity status that writers are given now is ultimately harmful to the industry. Like I said and like Red said, it's the industry can't keep this up. I think that because ultimately this is a visual medium, and if you take away the artist, you have really, really fucking short books, and that's not sustainable. So they really need to. They really need to pare it down, understand that writers can't be so big that they can be uncontrollable anymore. You have to have the editors be able to rein them in and write books that people actually fucking want now versus books that are statements that nobody will buy. I don't know. Is there much more else we can touch on this topic, or do you think that's the long and short of it, guys?
I think that's the long and short. I do have one final idea. Okay. Is... given the proliferation of animated works and live-action films based on comic books, it brings a whole new level and a different type of fame to these writers and artists that created these works. And unfortunately, that's kind of endemic of how much of a business, like, you don't realize that as a fan sometimes, how much of a business comic books are. Like, you spoke before we got on the mic here, Ben, about how Black Panther got Best Picture nominated for the Oscars. Now, again, I'm not saying it doesn't deserve it. I would never say that. I think it's a great film. I find it refreshing that a comic book film is up for an Oscar after how many goddamn years?
It doesn't deserve it. It's producing.
Exactly. Like, that's the thing. Like, it's great that it's there, but that's really more of a political move than any testament of its worth.
If Black Panther's good, I don't think it's Oscar worthy, though.
Yeah.
Golden Globes at best.
Please don't strike me down, Lord. This is like when Shakespeare in Love beat fucking Saving Private Ryan.
I haven't seen either of those movies, honestly. So
you've never seen Saving Private Ryan?
Well, that came out at a time when I was really ignorant about the stuff I was viewing. And
okay.
To this day, I've never made up for that lapse in judgment. But yeah, it's just saying movies, you know, the success of the Marvel Cinematic Universe has irrevocably changed the type of fame and the level of fame creators will get in their works. I mean, so much so now that, you know, they write shorter stories that are easy to collect in trades and like, hey, this could be a movie, you know? So, yeah, that's the last thing I have to say on the topic.
All right, well, Red, any last things to say on this topic?
Last thing to say on this comic is, or this topic is, instead of just pushing one or the other artist or writers, why don't you just give them a chance and push both? Why don't you try to make some fucking money and hire some good fucking artists that people like and some good fucking writers and put them together and actually make some decent fucking comics? And so.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right. Well, this is your host, Ben.
JT from Saskatoon.
Red Ink.
And we're saying goodnight.
So long.
Peace out.